There was a certain man in Caesarea called Cornelius, a centurion of the band called the Italian band. So the purpose of these people being banded together was what? Soldiers to fight. Is that it? Now you know that some army units and marine units have numbers, and some have names. Those which have particularly distinguished themselves in a battle often get a name. So this Italian band was a particular company which had distinguished itself. So it had a perpetuating name. All right, that's the main use of the word in Scripture, if we were to go through, as it refers to a band of military people. Now I think we're more interested in two verses, the first one in 1 Samuel 10:26. And Bob Wallace, would you read that for us? 1 Samuel 10:26.
And Saul also went home to Gibeah, and there went with him a band of men whose hearts God had touched.
Okay, this is descriptive, then, isn't it? This doesn't need any elaboration. That's what we're looking for. Now, in 2 Chronicles 30, chapter 30 and verse 12, we have the other half here. And let's see, who's found it already? Here, Jim North, do you have it?
Also in Judah, the hand of God was to give him one heart to do the commandment of the king and the princes by the word of the Lord.
Okay, now what was the characteristic here? Over in 1 Samuel 10:26, they were a band of men whose hearts God had touched. Now, what was this touch, a characteristic of it, as we see it in 2 Chronicles here? Jim?
Obedience. One heart. Obedience.
All right, they were of one heart, united in this. With that introduction now, we'll try to just lay out the broad area we're going to try to cover. Then we'll come back to this band in a little bit. But we have three sessions scheduled here, and in the first one, as we talk about a band of men, we're going to talk about the chief minister in the band. Now this is from scripture Leroy used last night, Mark 10, 42-44. So let's take a look at that. I'd like for somebody to read it, if it has it. That'll be a prize for the people who find it first, shouldn't they? Get to read it. Don, have you got it?
And Jesus called them to him and said to them, "You know that those who are supposed to rule the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them. But it shall not be so among you. But whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be slave of all."
All right. What terminology do we use when we're speaking of a band? It's composed of about two categories of people. Who are they? We just can't get away from that terminology.
Leader and followers.
Yeah, as a leader and as followers. Now, I know that we're going to revert constantly to saying leader, but what we mean is the chief minister in the band. Okay, we'll discuss him today, some of his qualities, and some of his techniques. And tomorrow, we're going to get into the members of the band. And then the third day, the ministry of the band. At least that's the outline. I don't know how close we'll follow. Now, what we want to consider here first, I think, is the very ultimate in what a band of men should be in the relationships one with another. And I have five relationships here that I would like for us to explore. First of all, we'll talk about, and we might as well not try to keep away from this, we talk about the leader. We'll just go ahead and call it the leader of the band. In Mark 10:45, the next verse after the ones we just read, somebody can give that to us from memory, I'm sure. Who can quote that for us?
For even the Son of Man came not to minister unto, but to minister and to give his life a ransom for many.
All right. To give his life. Now, that's not the best verse in the New Testament, but we could find a number if we'd search through which showed that it was Christ's ultimate goal to lay down his life for his calling, for his mission. Is that right? So, we'll explore this a little bit further, but this is the ultimate in the leader of a band. So sold on his calling that he is willing to lay down his life in the accomplishing of it. Do you know very many people who have done that? You remember hearing Dick Hillis talk about the communist officer that he knew and talked with in the early days of communist China when he was still over there. And this officer had led his band of men into the city and captured the city in which Dick was living. And as Dick talked with him, he said, well, his next goal was the next city. So Dick said, well, I'm not a military man. But he said, you're crazy. Now, there wasn't much opposition in this city. But you know what the nationalists have got down there. You haven't got a chance. So the officer was a little bit surprised that he talked to him like that. And he said, I know that the opposition is great. But he said, I would gladly lay down my life to take communism a mile further. Exactly what he said. For his calling. The characteristic of the leader of a group is that he's one who is willing to lay down his life for his mission and his calling. Now the next thing we see in here, in John 10:11, he's willing to do something else. Now, you pick that up, tell me what that is.
Give his life
to the sheep. All right. He's willing to lay down his life for his men in the band. In John 15, Christ said, greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friend. Well, I would imagine that most of us, we might as well check out and say, well, this is not for me. As far as being a leader of a band, because I don't think I'm that sold on the gospel, on Christ, are you? And if you had a band, would you be that sold? As I was thinking over this, I remembered Dawson Trotman. I got up to Scroon Lake on Monday morning, early in the morning, 6:30, after he had drowned, or after the Lord had taken him, at 4 o'clock the afternoon before. So I was very interested in the details of what had gone on, and I interviewed the girl whose life he had saved. Get all the first-hand information I could from her. And then tried to picture what was going on in his mind. And I think that Dawson Trotman was having a conversation with the Lord as he was there and he was holding her up. She wasn't a Archibald didn't weigh as much as he did, but cold water. And apparently it took about all the strength he had just to keep her above water since she couldn't swim. And I think as he was talking with the Lord, he said, Lord, I'm gone out of steam here. And it looks like I got a choice to make. Either I let her sink or get a little oxygen myself. This situation's getting serious. And I think the Lord said, well, just hang on. And he said, yeah, but what a tragedy it'd be if I didn't make it here. And then he began to enumerate to the Lord all this, all this, all this. So, I think the Lord just told him, well, hang on. Billy Graham, in commenting on Dawson Trotman's going, said, you know, I think that the Lord held a special council in heaven the day before. And he gathered the people around and said, well, it's time to bring Trotman home, that his work is ended. But this can't be just an ordinary event, that his exit from the world has got to be in keeping with the dramatic life that he's lived. And when Time magazine wrote up the article on his life and death, remember they had his picture in there, and the caption they had on the picture was, always holding someone up. Now, the thought that I wanted to convey here, that I don't think that it was as great a struggle for him as I might have pictured, because it was absolutely contrary to his way of thinking and his whole manner of life not to put other people and love other people above himself. He was in an impossible situation. He couldn't put himself above her. But this is an unusual quality, to be willing to lay down our life. All right, this is leadership. Now in the group, there are three relationships, I think, required of those that are in the band. But let's illustrate this other step further here. I think Leroy quoted this verse last night, Acts 20, 24. As they told Paul what was going to come, and as the prophet of God told him what was going to come, he says, but none of these things move me, neither count I my life dear unto myself. So what? If the giving up of his life was a part of the accomplishing of his calling, his mission, well, he didn't count it dear unto himself. For his mission, then for his people. In Romans 9:3, he said, for I could wish that myself were accursed from Christ for my brother and my kinsman according to the flesh. I don't think we'd call this a ban, but he said, if it would better them, I'm willing to have my name blotted out of the book of life and forfeit my right to eternal life for their sake. You ever thought about that? You'd like to, if giving up your salvation could accomplish something for somebody else, would you like to forfeit it? Of course, that's an impossible situation. Moses, in Exodus 32, you remember after that he'd spent the 40 days with the Lord, and they made the golden calf, and then he was down kind of angry about it, and so was the Lord angry about it. And when he found out the Lord was angry about it too, well, he kind of cooled off a little bit. In verse 31, in Moses 32, Exodus 32, 31, and Moses returned unto the Lord and said, oh, this people have sinned a great sin and have made them gods of gold. Yet now, if thou wilt forgive their sin, now that's what you should do. But he says, and if not, blot me, I pray thee, out of the book which thou hast written. You don't want to forgive them? Just blot me out too. on this. All right, this is the ultimate in leadership. Now let's take a look at the ultimate in the members. Same thing, first of all. In Romans 12:11, remember the last phrase of this? This group of people up there, it's being discussed in Romans 12:11. Now somebody check it for us. Last phrase. Anybody?
Serve the Lord.
I haven't got it here. I'm looking for the phrase, they love not their life unto the death. What did I say?
Romans.
Oh, excuse me. Revelation 12:11. I've got Revelation written down here. I don't know why I said Romans. Still over there with Paul, I guess. They love not their lives unto the death. So, a band member, this has got to be the ultimate in his belief that he doesn't love his life unto death for his mission. Now, we have this illustrated also in Daniel 3. Who was in this little band that we read about in Daniel? Who are the members? Who was the leader of the band? Daniel. And the three principal members were Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, and Glenary. I think we're going to have to teach future generations that Shadrach was a Bible character and not a horse. But in Daniel 3, really 249, Daniel's looking out for these three kids that were just barely teenagers, what they were. And he requested the king, and he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. So he got them in a pretty good slot. Well, then in the next chapter, built the image. Remember? It said, fall down and worship it. And they had a little talk with Daniel about this, I'm sure, although the record isn't in here. But he said, well, fellas, I don't want to give any direct counsel on this. But I'll tell you what I'm doing. And I think little did he know that not long after that, he was going to have an opportunity to prove it when he was thrown in the lion's den rather than compromised. But you know what they told the king? He said, now you think your God's able to deliver you? And I'm surprised that Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego didn't say, well, sure you can. But they said, well, we don't know. I've tried to read into language here that they said, we don't know whether it's his will or not. And that's not what it says in there. They said, we don't know whether he can or not. But we know one thing. We're not going to bow down to that image. That's one thing we're sure about. And they didn't. Did they? So they were willing to give up their life for their mission. The same as Daniel was a little bit later when he was thrown in the lion's den. Now, in the followers, the next thing we want to see here is in 1 Chronicles 11:16. This area here. This is got a lot of Native people around here, and ex-Native people, and people who wish they had been. This is good old nautical terminology here. And David was then in the hold. Yeah. Well, there are a lot of caves in this part of the country, down around Bethlehem. And the Philistines' garrison was then at Bethlehem. Some of you know that I was over there in May. The coolest time of the year. I'd hate to be there in the hottest time of the year. But apparently this was it. And the Philistines had captured Bethlehem. And there's a few caves around there, not many trees, and a little water. And David was on down one of these other valleys in a cave. And, well, you know what he said here. He said, "I sure wish that I had a drink of water out of the gate up there at Bethlehem." Well, three of his guys and his band heard him say that. And what does it say they did? And the three break through the host of the Philistines. Now, you think that means they sneak through? Is that what it said? How'd they get through? Now, who do you think got broke all the way through? They broke through. The host. This was a kind of bloody encounter, I think. And got to the well, got a bucket of water, brought it to David. And when he saw their bloody scars and the lumps on their head and all that, what did he do? Poured it out. Now we're going to come back to this as a principle a little bit later. But what he said, verse 19, "My God forbid it me that I should do this thing. Shall I drink the blood of these men that have put their lives in jeopardy? Or with the jeopardy of their lives they brought it." Now, who were these three particular guys who did this? Where did they rate in the organization that he had? They were the three mightiest. Now, if we get into this catalog of mighty men here, which we probably will a little bit later, he talks about a mighty man, but he said he wasn't one of the three mightiest. They talk about another mighty man, but he wasn't one of the, he didn't have the stature of the three. Now, the reason I think that these guys were a little bit bloody after this battle, they not only risked their lives, but they probably left more blood back there in gallons than they brought water to them. Well, did he figure that they were willing to lay down their life for him? You think they were? Mm-hmm. All he said is, "I sure we've had a drink out of that well of Bethlehem." That's what they did. In World War II, there was a very controversial figure by the name of George Patton. Now, a lot of people wondered why that Eisenhower kept him around. But he had his reasons, even though he had his troubles. Well, let me read it here. Got a note here someplace. Now, this isn't one I was looking for. I guess I got two notes here. And I'll read this anyway. "His emotional tenseness and his impulsiveness were the very qualities that made him, in open situations, such a remarkable leader of an army. In pursuit and exploitation, there is need for a commander who sees nothing but the necessity of getting ahead. The more he drives his men, the more he will save their lives. He must be indifferent to fatigue and ruthless in demanding the last atom of physical energy." Now, the quote I've got here that I thought I'd made a note of, but I can't find it. He said he was the most remarkable soldier that the world had ever produced. This was his evaluation of him, so he put up with a few things. Well, as far as Patton is concerned, what was his attitude? He told about the first time he reprimanded him. He said, after the incident was all over, my old friend George sent me a long letter in which the following appeared. I am at loss to find words with which to express my chagrin and grief at having given you a man to whom I owe everything and for whom I would gladly lay down my life, cause to be displeased with me. Well, I don't know whether Patton meant that or not, but that's why he wrote to Eisenhower. He said, you're the man I would gladly lay down my life for. So the members of the band will lay down their life for their calling, will lay down their life for their leader, and now finally, they will lay down their lives for each other. So you've got a third relationship in here. Now, I don't know any biblical illustrations of this, although it's commanded in 1 John 3:16. Let's look that up. What does it say? Somebody know from memory?
Hereby pursue the love of God, because he laid down his life for us, and we lay down our life for
them. Okay, what John said we should do?
Lay down our life for them.
And Romans 5 says that this is something that even a righteous man will scarcely do. Didn't he? And this was the great contradiction of Christ. My man won't even do this for his friends. But Christ, when we were yet his enemies, he laid down his life for us. Do you know any biblical illustration of a man who laid down his life for another? Jonathan talked that way about David, didn't he? Well, there probably are some, but I just didn't think of any when I was working this over. All right, let's review what we've gone over so far. We've talked about five relationships, two for the leader and three for the member of the band. So for the leader, what's the first one? What's his attitude? The ultimate in his attitude. All right, he's willing to lay down his life for the cause. And I think we can be a little more specific and say for his calling, for his objective. And secondly, he's willing to do what? Lay down his life for his men. Now, the follower, the member of the band, has the same two relationships, but he has a third. What is it? Willing to lay down his life for the other members of the band. Well, shall we just check out and say we're disqualified? Let's go home. It's not for me. If you were a member or a leader of this kind of a band, you think its influence would be felt? I counted up in my Bible here. It's on page 471 here in the First Chronicles 12. It lists the number of the army of David, the people that made him king. And I listed these numbers and added them up in my margin. I came up with 296,600 members of the army it gives each tribe. But we don't know much about the majority of them. But the 33 that composed his band are identified by name. And we're going to talk more about it in these discussions here. So I don't think that the 296,600 could have made much of an imprint if it hadn't been for the 33. You remember how the number one boy there, how many people did he kill at once? 800. That was the number three man to kill 300. Number one man.
No, isn't at least three?
McVarden?
These three that you were talking about earlier?
The three mighty, and they were part of the 33. I think it was 33, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. Give us their names over here in 2 Samuel. Tell us how many they were. We're going to talk about the last man on the totem pole before we get through here. He was Uriah. 2 Samuel 5 gives him here. Didn't got the number either. Where did I get this number? It says 33. What verse?
25.
Yeah. Okay. There was the mighty and the mighties and the others, but he had the three of them. 800 people. Sergeant York didn't get that many, did he? And the second guy, what was it to impress David about him? He got out there and fought so hard that when the battle was over, they tried to tell, they told him, well, battle's all over, just lay down your sword. But he had a little difficulty. What was the difficulty?
His hand.
He groaned his hand. His hand had grown around it. Paralyzed. I don't know how he got it loose. But it was locked on the sword. Mm-hmm. Well, if we were the leader or the member of a mighty band like that, perhaps we could make some influence for Christ. Now, I want to pose another question here, and that is, which is the most difficult, to die for Christ or to live for Him? You said to live, Bob. Now, we've covered a lot of territory for nothing in there, haven't we? I don't know just how it fits in, but I think that this basic attitude is a prerequisite to being willing to live for Christ, is to be willing to die for Him. Now, it seems like it should be just the other way, shouldn't it? But I don't think it is. Maybe we'll discuss that more at a later time. So in Luke 9:24, Christ had something to say about this. I know many of you have memorized that. Who wants to give us Luke 9:24? For whosoever will save his life shall lose it. But whosoever will lose his life for my sake, the same shall save it. How's he talking about dying? In here? Does it seem like the Lord is interested in anybody dying for Him? What's He interested in? Living for Him. And that's much more difficult than dying for Him. But this attitude, as I say, seems to be a prerequisite to the motivation to live. Be willing to lay down for Him. All right, now we're going to just try to proceed along here, and we'll stretch occasionally. So need to. Why should you or anybody else be interested in a band of men? When does this become necessary? Now, I want to keep progressing here, so let me make a suggestion. One definition of leadership is, leadership is accomplishing your objectives through the efforts of others. Now this begins to point out why that we need a leader and members in the band. Because God has given to a man an objective that the only possible way that it can be accomplished is through the efforts of others. Now, there are other reasons we might get together to band them. I listed several last night. I should have given them first. One reason is to look successful. We're talking about this a lot around the Navigators these days. Well, that's kind of proof is whether you can succeed or not. It's whether you got a band of men around you, didn't it? Well, how successful do you think that would be? This is the motivation. Well, if I can get enough people around, I won't have to do anything myself. I can recruit somebody to do the work. I can go fishing. Isn't that a good reason to get a band? When does a band of men become a necessity? Gene?
Perhaps when the purpose of the objective is too big to accomplish it by itself.
That's right. That's what I think. When God has given you an objective, it's on your heart and you've got to do it. But you can't do it yourself. Your objective has got to be accomplished utilizing the efforts of others. All right, this is another thing we're going to come back to. You think this is incoherent? You should have seen my first, second, third, and fourth, fifth, and fifth set of notes. Now, I hope we're going to tie these things together. But we want to talk a little bit now about the quality of the person who becomes the chief minister of the band. The man that God calls to an objective that is bigger than he is, bigger than his quality. Do you have any ideas to why these three mighty men felt so loyal to David that he said, "Well, I wish I had a drink out of that well." And they should have said, "Yeah, that's the way the general. You know, he got all the water he wants, but he wants a special drink out of that well outside the gate of Bethlehem." Wouldn't you have done that? I said, "Hey, old man, slip a little bit. Let me know that there's 300 Philistines between here and that well, or 3,000. What in the world was it that instilled a loyalty so that we say in military terminology these days that the captain's slightest wish is a command? He doesn't get all of his wishes, does he? Not very many people would feel that way about him, but these guys do. Well, let's take a look at the first insight we have into David's character in 1 Samuel 16:18. Saul had bad nerves. Moody individual. One day last summer during a conference, we were sitting down at the table with Dr. Edmund for breakfast, and something was made about the person who didn't, who had asked the Lord's blessing on the meal, didn't talk very loud. So he told us about the old Scandinavian. when he prayed, the more he prayed, the more volume that he got. And sometimes it was to the embarrassment of the people who were praying with him, where his voice would ring out in all the rooms around. So one day one of them said to him, said, "Brother Swenson, now we want to say this in love, but we got some news for you." "Okay, what is it?" I said, "God is not deaf." So the old sweep said, "I got news for you. He's not nervous either." But Saul was nervous. And he asked for a musician. So his staff brought him a recommendation. And over in 1 Samuel 16:18, "Then answered one of the servants and said, 'Behold, I have seen a son of Jesse the Bethlehemite, that is cunning in playing, and a mighty valiant man, and a man of war, and prudent in matters, and a comely person, and most of all, and the Lord is with him.'" I don't think there's very many people in Scripture that had a recommendation like that. How would you express some of these qualities in your own language? Nancy?
This isn't exactly my own, but I just found a study on David, and it says in Berkeley of him that he is a good fighter, of sound judgment, well built, and the Lord is with him.
Okay. He's a master musician as well as a master soldier. Do you think he was handsome? Well, if he wasn't handsome physically, he was personality-wise, that he attracted people. Now, about his character, what happened when the three mighty men handed him the water? What did he do? Poured it out. Why do you think he did that? Well, he said he didn't, wouldn't he? He didn't want anything that his men didn't have. Well, we're going to make a list of these things after a while. They keep coming to the surface here. Over in the city of Jerusalem today, the city is partitioned, as you know, the Jewish and Arab sector has a no man's land in between with barbed wire entanglements and troops. And I think one of the hardest things for the Jewish sector must be to realize that David's tomb is in the no man's land. They don't have access to it. Of course, neither do the Arabs. But here, one of the most important spots for the Jews, barbed wire on both sides. Now, something we're going to get into here tomorrow, and I almost feel like we need to take an advanced look at it. And this is the case of Uriah. Well, we've just mentioned this, and we'll study into it later. Maybe you want to do some studying tonight on it. He was one of the 33 mighty men. Did you know that? And he was perhaps overshadowed by some of the others, but he managed to court and win the Miss Jerusalem of 900 B.C. She might have been Miss Universe. I kind of get the idea that she could have won the contest. What was her name? Bathsheba. And you know the story, how that David, instead of leading his men in battle the way that he used to, why he sent Joab out there. And he saw Bathsheba taking a bath on a neighboring roof, and being a very righteous man, he realized it was wrong to add her to his harem because she was a wife of one of his soldiers. So he cooked up a real good deal. You remember all about it. But his conscience kind of hurt him a little bit. So he said, sent word up to the battlefront, he'd like to have Uriah come down. So he sat down in his big throne room on Mount Zion. And he said, well, how's the war going? And I think Uriah said, look, I'm not the commander-in-chief out here. I don't hold any particular spot, you know. It must have been really flattering to have him call him back and say, how's the war going? But he talked it over. This is what the account says. He discussed the war, the battle, and gave him a little hint about what he ought to do, you know, just like he was the commander-in-chief over there. Then he said, by the way, take some time off. You know, go on home. Take a little R&R here. And then he told the king to, or told his servants to send over some chow that night off of his table, so he and Bathsheba could really celebrate. So the next morning, he thought his conscience was eased a little bit for what he had in mind. But he's really upset when one of the servants said, you know, you told Uriah to go home. He didn't even go home. And he said, well, what did he do? That he just slept on him. Step outside the castle here. So David called him in again. He said, why didn't you go home last night? Well, I told you. So old Uriah, he rehearsed about it. And he said, look, my buddies are living in tents. And they're in a battle. And what kind of a weakling or representative of that outfit would I be if I took a vacation, went home, lived like a civilian? When there's a war going on. So old David, he wrote him a note, and he sealed it top secret, and don't you open this. Because in this note, he said, now you give this to Joab. And this note said, now when Uriah gives you this note, you take him and put him in the hottest part of the battle. And as soon as he's been killed, let me know. So, you remember, Joab took him, and the account says that he put him where the valiant men were. And, of course, in due time, he was killed. And then this made it all legal and nice for David to go ahead and marry Bathsheba. Well, then you remember that Nathan came to him, and he told David, he said, we got a problem here in the kingdom. We got a guy that's a disgrace in our outfit. He'd do something about it. And David said, well, what's the problem? He said, well, he, as a rich man, he owns half the country out there in this area here, cattle, servants, and so forth. And he's got a neighbor that's real poor. And the only thing he's got in his, the only resource he's got is a sheep that he raised up from a lamb, pet in the household, and so forth. But this rich guy had a neighbor dropping on him, or a visitor, rather, and so they had to have mutton that night for the banquet. So instead of taking one of his, he went over to this guy who only had one, and he stole him away and brought him over and slaughtered him for a feast. So old David jumped off of his throne, and he said, give me his name. He will die for this. You know what Nathan did, don't you? Turned around and pointed his finger. He said, thou art the man. Now we're already jumped over into our next group here, and this is a band member. And I want you to give some thought to this. This reader brought it up today. When David told him to come home, he came home. He obeyed him. But he apparently had lost his respect for him as a leader. And he wouldn't obey him to go home and take it easy on himself. But when he was sent back to be killed at David's command, he obeyed him in this. Now, this is some food for thought here on the member of the band. You know, what is his allegiance to his leader? You see in here, because here are some conflicts. He came home, he disobeyed, and yet he died for the cause at David's command. And I don't think Uriah was so naive that he didn't know why he was being put out there with the valiant men. He knew it wasn't to win a medal that he was being put out. All right, we're going to get back to David again here. Why would these three mighty men risk their lives to do this? Poor old David, he decayed later, didn't he? And yet Uriah, one of the mighty men, he went out there and died for him, even after that.